Judah, do you want me to make you the host?
Only I want to share something. Is that, do I need to be a host to share?
No, you don't need to be a host to share.
That's fine. You can, you're hosting. That's
okay. It's being recorded, just so you know, all of this. But so far, the only one who requested a recording was Bracha Krohn.
And my mother.
And your mother, right? And your mother. I'm going to keep everyone but you on mute.
Sure. And I guess people can write in any comments they have.
It's like a big family reunion, Judah, for you.
Most of can't get away. This is already recorded, Ellie?
Yes, of course, okay. You want me to stop recording for a moment?
I think you should probably begin the recording again at the opening of the,
okay.
The program. And for every Weitzman show as well. Young Israel, a great neck. I visited not long ago, and that's really where the story starts. I'll get to that in a little bit. And nice to see people again. The Israel Plainview. We did visit. We came for Shabbos in 2005. That was 15 years ago. And we had the chance to share Torah with you. And I can't say I remember everyone's faces from then, but nice to see that crowd again. Just one more point as an introduction. You know, one always thinks that their own life is boring and the adventure is happening elsewhere. And so when Rabbi Weissman invited me to come speak about my experiences working in a I guess, a Corona emergency department here in Israel. I said, sure, I'm happy to share that with you, but it seems to me the action's really going on in New York. We're working hard, and we're working with dedication. But I think I feel almost pampered, compared to the conditions and the challenges that my colleagues in New York and elsewhere in North America are dealing with. And I think they are the real heroes: the doctors, the nurses, and all of the support staff. And I really salute them and all of their efforts as well. I also do have to acknowledge all the many people who have signed on. I'm embarrassed to admit the number that I'm related to or that my wife is related to. But I was going to mention that one of my colleagues that I'm working side by side with in Shari Tzedek and the Corona AD is Dr. Abby Bienenfeld, who I think is well known to the Young Israel Plainview. But then I saw, Abby, that you are signed on to this already. So if you have anything to add, anything you think I'm whitewashing, glossing over, glorifying, feel free to step in and interrupt. I wanted to start by just telling you a little bit about myself. I was born and bred in Teaneck, New Jersey, across the bridge, across the George Washington. And throughout many years of schooling, for a long time, I grappled with two competing attractions, one to medicine and another to Jewish education. And I really grappled for a very long time about how to make a career choice for myself. And I think I could say in some sense that I really never did, and that I decided to try to keep both of those things in play. And that's kind of been the way I've functioned since, specifically since I finished the medical training and we moved to Israel about 9 years ago. Since then, I've spent the majority of my time involved in Jewish education, and I've been worked in emergency medicine as my specialty part-time. Right now, I teach in Midrashim Mevaseret Yerushalayim, otherwise known as MMY, a post-high school seminary for women. And I'm there a few days a week in Yerushalayim. One shift a week, I work in Shari Tzedek, in the emergency department, with Dr. Bienenfeld and with others. And then I also travel to Florida, and I spend several weeks a year there, not consecutively, a few different trips. I spend up to 2 weeks at a time in Florida, working in an emergency department in South Florida. And deliberately, my work in medicine is modest, particularly in Shari Tzedek. It's really one shift a week. That's been a choice in my life because I did want to be able to engage fully in Jewish education. And so that's the balance that I've sought for myself until now. Now, in terms of the current events, I guess I'll back up to, gosh, it's about 7 weeks ago. I think as anyone here's either from the Young Israel Great Neck or from the Dvoretsky extended family on this Zoom knows that my family and my wife's entire family, meaning all her siblings and children, and others all had the very special pleasure of spending the weekend of Shabbos Zachor and Purim in Great Neck. It was a wonderful celebration of my in-laws' 45 years in their Shul Young Israel Great Neck and of their upcoming Aliyah, B'Shah Tova Mitzlacha, Abba Nima. Looking back, if I mentioned Shabbos Zachor and Purim, so I think to all of us that unwittingly, we didn't know it, but there was literally a pandemic unfolding under our noses and perhaps in our noses. Little did we know it. How much hindsight we have now, what was going on that week. For better or for worse, we didn't know it, and therefore we had a really fantastic weekend. By the time we were supposed to fly the day after Purim, we ended up flying the Motzei Purim. By the time we flew, we knew that Israel was going to put us into isolation just for having been in New York, which we did. We came home. We were just so happy to be back in our own house in familiar territory. And we snuggled up ready to spend the next 2 weeks together. About 2 days later, I came down with a fever, as did a lot of other family members around the world. And I that continued for me for the next 10 days. Thank God my symptoms were only mild. And thank God I had an easy recovery. But I was really out of commission, and I knew that I was literally taboo. I was untouchable for a long time. And the idea of my working anywhere or helping out in any emergency department was a non-starter. And so I kind of, for quite a while, I put it aside in my mind that I'm on, called the victim side of this, so to speak. I am, and I am not going to have a role in treating. And I guess the unknown was even more terrifying now. Sometimes, even in the face of something very vicious, the unknown is in some ways even scarier than after we've seen some of its damage. And I was so happy to lock my door and stay behind closed doors for as long as I could. Thank God, eventually my fever stopped and I felt better. And at some point after that, I felt like I at least had to reach out to my emergency department, touch base with them, and confirm that they had no need for me and that they didn't want to see me until the fall. Somehow, I don't know why I convinced myself that would be so. It really went against all logic. I guess I imagined that I'd reach out to the emergency department, and even if they thought that I was healthy and cleared to work, that their, in Hebrew they call it the miyun biologi, which is not a very tough translation of the miyun is the emergency department, the biologi mean the biological miyun, mean anyone who has any suspicion of possibly having COVID-19, the formal name for what most people call the coronavirus. They had set it up, they were working in teams, they had a very rigid format to make sure that people weren't going to be exposed and contaminated and contaminate others. And I figured there's no way they don't want me, they're up and running. Maybe, if anything, they'll have me continue to work my one shift a week and continue to see the other patients, everyone who at that time, astonishingly, and I think this is true in, you know, in the updates I get from emergency departments across America as well, that at that time, non-corona related complaints had slowed to a trickle. But they still needed doctors, and I assumed if they were gonna involve me at all, so I would get to see the chest pains and the belly pains and so on. Again, I say I was totally naive, and I don't know why, but when I reached out, my my director wrote back that in fact, what they really needed was help staffing the corona ED, and not only asking could I come and work the shift that I'm used to working, but could I be doing more for them and step up during this crisis time. Now, I give a lot of credit, I give a shout out to my my boss, the director of the Shaarei Tzedek Emergency Department, Dr. Todd Zalut, a fellow American Ole, who parenthetically did many things in his career, but many years ago was, I think, the assistant director of the department, assistant to Dr. David Applebaum, Hashem Yikum Damo, until Dr. Applebaum was murdered together with his daughter in a bomb in the middle of Yerushalayim. And since then, Dr. Zalut stepped up and has assumed the helm of Shaarei Tzedek's emergency department. Dr. Zalut said to me that I want you to come work, but I want you to come see our operation first, see what we've set up, see how we're functioning, make sure you're comfortable with it, that it's to your liking, and then before you do anything, go home and talk to your wife about it, because I need to make sure to have her consent as well. I don't want any heroes who are doing it not with the agreement and comfort of their family. If your family's behind it, then we'd love to have you come aboard. On the one hand, looking back, I really was hoping that his email would say, thanks, but no thanks. Enjoy, you know, your cup of tea and Zoom all you want. We don't need you. On the other hand, as soon as one of those things that you pretend is a big deliberation, and then when you decide, you realize that it was decided long ago, as someone once put it, compared to Bedikas Chametz, that you pretend you don't know what you're looking for, and meanwhile you've laid out the bread ahead of time. By the time I went to visit and came home and discussed it with my wife Shana and so on, it was pretty clear what I thought I ought to be doing, both because of the moral calling of the crisis itself, and particularly even in terms of what it would mean that I would have to cut down on my teaching and adjust my schedule. In that respect, allow me to teach a little Torah or learn a little Torah with you in the context of this talk. And I'm gonna, we've all tried to learn how to use Zoom here. Ellie, give me, Rabbi Weissman, give me a thumbs up. Everyone seeing my shared screen? Okay, good. I just wanted to learn one halacha with you in the Rambam that I tried to keep front and center in my life in general, and this time in particular, which I think informed kind of the rebalance that I did for myself. The Rambam, it's not original, the Rambam, is quoting the Gemara, but the Rambam says, Hayala fanav asiyat mitzvah v'talmud Torah. A person is engaged in learning or wants to engage in Torah study, but also has a mitzvah that needs to be performed. That if the person, if the mitzvah can be done by others, then the person need not interrupt his own learning. But if not, he ought to perform the mitzvah, and when that need has been filled, return to his Torah study. And so on the one hand, I have commitments to my teaching. And I knew working more frequently in the hospital would get in that way. On the other hand, it was clear that that's okay as long as other people to do the work. And thank God, the world has a lot of doctors, and I don't think that I'm so spectacular that they need me at any point. Both Shari Tzedek and the Florida Emergency Departments, their schedules are filled. But in this case, when there was an ongoing urgent need and we needed more staffing in the Corona day, I think it was obvious to me that Chazal, the Rambam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all the above, would want me to cut down on my teaching and instead to step up in terms of the emergency department. And that's what I did. And that's what I've found myself doing along with Dr. Bienenfeld and others. I've had to give up on some of my MMY teaching. I cut down on my courses so that I could be doing more frequent shifts in the emergency department. I guess for those of you from the Israel of Great Neck that I saw only 7 weeks ago, one change that I had to shave in the meantime. Rabbi Weissman, you still look the same age, but I've actually gained about 10 more years, if not more, since we last saw each other, in order that the respirator mask would fit tightly. Facial hair impedes that, and so people with much more impressive beards than I have shaven them. In fact, one of my colleagues sent a shy letter of Usher Weiss consulting about shaving his beard in order to work in the emergency department. And his response was, it will grow back. So that worked for me as well. God willing, maybe one day I will have facial hair again. We're using maximum precautions in the emergency department. Everything that you see in the news, and really no different than any other hospital in New York or elsewhere. Just to give you a quick sense of what that means, and I'm sure it's true I see a lot of different faces. I see intensivists on here, and any one of you, you know, has exactly the same experience and can share it as well. I take nothing to the emergency, to the hospital. I take a car key, my credit cards, and my phone, and nothing else. I want nothing else coming and going. I change into scrubs there. From the stepping into the Corona ED, doctors, nurses, everyone is wearing a gown, wearing a mask, wearing gloves, put on a hat. And then for each patient that we see, on top of that, another gown, another pair of gloves, a face mask, and then just be really careful the way you take all that off and disinfect between patients that you see. You don't want to infect yourself, and you certainly don't want to transfer Corona from a Corona positive patient to a patient who may not have, in fact, the coronavirus. thank God in Israel, we have not had any supply issues. I know that was a major issue in many other places and in many hospitals. And it's I feel very lucky. I feel very thankful to our Shari Tzedek leadership and to the Israeli, the health ministry in general, that they've made sure that that supply has stayed, has continued. No one wants to be in a place where you feel like you're being sent out to the, you know, to the battlefront and you don't have the right armor. And so that's critical. At first, it's a little bit onerous and you can always be very compulsive about it, about did you contaminate yourself? Did you touch this? Did you touch that? But honestly, after a few shifts, you get pretty used to it and you kind of forget where you're working and what's at stake. Now, Rabbi Weissman invited me, and I think the title said something about an Israeli rabbi and physician wrestles with a pandemic. And it led me to thinking, is there something really unique about the Israeli experience here? In some sense, I think not at all. In fact, if anything, this pandemic, as a pandemic, has been an incredible equalizing force across the globe. And populations are doing the same thing across the globe, and doctors and nurses are contending with the same issues. And in some way, Israel is just another country that's had its own share of corona. If I were to think about anything that makes the Israeli response not necessarily different or unique, but distinctively Israeli, what does it mean to be in Israel at this time? And even perhaps, what are some of the things that might have helped us deal with the pandemic? So I think three things come to mind that I wanted to share with you. One is that Israelis are great at dealing with crises. In fact, we're much better at dealing with crises than we are at dealing with regular life. In some ways, you know, Israel just passed its 72nd birthday and it's functioned best as a country that has reeled from crisis to crisis for 72 years. And we actually get kind of unnerved and antsy when there's no crisis. And we're still trying to figure that part out about how to deal with regular life. But when it comes to crisis, we're really good at that. We're prepped for emergencies. I think the whole country, not just the army, but the citizenship, the citizenry as well, really has a military mentality. We've seen threats on our own soil. The same Pikud HaOref, which is the home front, which is in charge of leading the battle against coronavirus. I know it's a touchy issue whether you should refer to coronavirus in military terms. So I guess let me take that back. Leading the confrontation against coronavirus. It's the same Pikud HaOref that's in charge of the red alerts that we all listen to if there's rockets from Gaza, if there's a threat of rockets from Lebanon, and so on. And so the country as a whole is well primed to respond to crisis and to do what's necessary. And whatever, whether it's staying home, whether it's isolation, whether it's everything being shut down, the same thing that's been dealt with elsewhere as well. I tried to explain to some of my colleagues in Shari Tzedek that I don't think most Americans are familiar, myself included, with an American home front command, that there has not been a military threat on the continental U.S. soil in 208 years by my counting. So it's not as familiar. But in Israel, it is a part of our everyday lives. In fact, the crises are normal, and the normal is not even so normal. Second aspect of life in Israel that I think is significant here is a real shared sense of national purpose and responsibility. It's a small country. It's a, for all of our infighting, a fairly united country. The strangers are really not so strange. There's the nursing home in a city that you don't visit, you don't know about, somewhere in Israel, could easily be your neighbor's grandmother or someone, or someone not so many degrees of separation apart. And there is a real sense of unity, I think, and of shared responsibility. and even the willingness of people to take steps in order to protect the public as a whole is palpable. And I think the third factor that helps us here is also a shared sense of mesirut nefesh, of willingness for self-sacrifice. It is an inherent part of the Israeli culture. Our children are bred from this from birth. Every Israeli child knows that down the line, and when they graduate high school, they're going to be asked to either enroll in the army or, as an alternative, Sheirut Lumi, but perform some kind of national service. And I think it's a really important part of our culture. We just passed Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut in Israel. And I think even harder than people spending the Seder alone was bereaved families not going to military cemeteries on Yom HaZikaron to honor fallen soldiers. That was really, really, really painful for the country as a whole. And yet it's something that people were willing, and the sense was that people were willing to do with a sense of pride and self-sacrifice, and to do it for the sake of the country.
Of course.
And I would say for myself that because having to go back to work at the hospital, I went to the sense of
bringing
him into the next world. Wow. As a professional responsibility, but I also had a sense that I was serving my people. We always imagine that for our family, I made Aliyah long after the age of army service. We always imagined that our first encounter with national service would be with our sons in the army. In fact, not so long ago, my 16-year-old got his draft letter for the army. And yet this feels like my personal national service. I'm guessing that my Israeli friends would say this is, you know, doesn't quite compare to their 16 months or 32 months, but you know, we all play our role. This is kivyachol my national service in Israel, and I think it makes it a little bit easier to do. I want to talk about, you know, my background is in medicine and emergency medicine, as well as in Limud HaKodesh. And another piece of my background is a degree in bioethics, and bioethics is a particular interest in mine. And I wanted to talk about some of the ethical issues that I've reflected upon in working in the Corona Emergency Department. I want to talk about three briefly. One that has to do with care for Corona patients in general, one that's specific to working in an emergency department, and a third that's not really even so medical, but more about the human dimension. I think probably the most talked about ethical issues surrounding the Corona pandemic has been the prospect of rationing. There were certainly points at which I haven't followed it so closely. I think in Italy and other places, they really had to deal with very serious rationing. I think it was certainly looming over the New York area for a while, but it seems like New York has been spared from rationing the use of ventilators. But certainly the question was out there, and it was very uncomfortable. I think it created an image, certainly in the public, of this idea that hospitals were going to have death panels, or not even death panels, just individual doctors deciding as if they were playing the role of God, of who will live and who will die. Too many patients, too few ventilators. Whom are we going to decide to save, and who are we going to give up on? And that is a really thorny issue. And lo aleinu, would that ever happen in any community, in any environment, in any context? It's a very difficult issue to deal with. But I do want to give it some context in the context of this pandemic that we're dealing with. I can't speak for the New York hospitals, but at least certainly for what we're dealing with in Israel. And this is to take a step back and talk about mechanical ventilation, or the role of putting patients, debilitated patients, on respirators in general. As a general point, when there's a surplus of resources, we often push off hard decisions. And that's true no matter what the resources are. You go to the supermarket and you're gonna decide between snack A and snack B, if your budget is not so tight, so you buy both of them and you don't have to think too hard about it. Maybe you don't need most of them. Maybe down the line you're going to throw one of them out. Maybe your money will actually be wasted. But still, sometimes it's easier to not make a decision if you don't really feel pushed to. And if I can say, as a participant in the U.S. health system, I think that's been at least partly my experience. A lot of other doctors here can weigh in and reflect as well. It seems to me, in my experience in U.S. healthcare, that let's say when it comes to trying to take life-saving means, even for patients who have small chances of recovery, the default in U.S. hospitals is to do everything for everybody unless someone steps in and changes that default. It can be changed by the family, it can be changed by doctor, it can be changed by palliative care service and in consultation, but the default is we're going to go full speed ahead and there's no procedure that's out of bounds, I would say. And really, we don't have to talk about every procedure. I think the major one, it's true during a pandemic, but it's true even not during the pandemic, during the day-to-day life of any emergency department, any intensive care unit, is about which patients do you want to take over their breathing and put them on a ventilator. But there are treatments that are not worth doing, even with infinite resources, that even if you had endless money and endless staff and endless beds, it still doesn't make sense to do. What kinds of treatments are those? So I'll put them in two categories. There's treatments that just don't help. They don't make anything better. A surgery that's just not going to solve the problem, or a pill that's just not going to make the patient feel any better or bring them any relief. That just doesn't make sense to do, not because it costs too much, but because it's futile and it makes no sense to engage in futile care. The second category, a little bit more subtle, is where there is a chance, possibly a small chance, but some chance of benefit from the treatment, but the likelihood of benefit does not outweigh the likelihood of harm. The treatment has downside to it. The treatment can lead to increased suffering, and the possible benefit, you know, it's a very careful calculation, but the possible benefit does not outweigh that. Now, some of the talk about ventilators, and I think some of hospitals, even in Shari Tzedek to a certain degree, hospitals' willingness to be more proactive or even more aggressive, I would say, in making those decisions up front of which patients would not benefit from mechanical ventilation, it's not so much in response to a pandemic and limited resources as much as maybe decisions that we should have been thinking about earlier, but we never did until the pandemic hit. Meaning there is patient populations, it's a very sensitive issue, but there are patient populations for whom
can hear us?
Taking over their breathing would either is not imagined to be effective, or the risks ultimately are higher than the benefits. But we kicked the can down the road. We punted those issues. Sometimes it's easier not to have to decide. Sometimes actually inertia and letting med doctors do what they know how to do is just easier. And the pandemic has not necessarily led us to be rationing that care, but to be making more rational decisions up front about who can benefit. This is not a lecture about end-of-life decision-making, but I'll make a couple of general observations. And I just think they're very familiar, certainly to any doctors in the audience and probably to most people who have been patients or family members or patients in the audience as well. Someone's breathing is failing and they are not going to continue to be able to breathe on their own. And the choice comes up, do I want to take over their breathing for them and put them on a respirator? So the biggest single factor is, what is the patient's baseline functioning before this happened? And this happens all the time. I see it in the emergency department. I have very little information. Patients come in, unfortunately, in critical states. And when I have the opportunity, if there's family there, I can say to them, you know, Tell me about your loved one. Tell me about their diseases and their illnesses up until now. Were they fine until a week ago, and is this was a rapid decline, or have they had dementia for several years? Are they at baseline able to feed themselves, able to dress themselves, or are they bedbound? Are they able to communicate with you, or have you not had communication in a long time? And all these things, I think, are really significant. It may seem obvious, and I'll say what may be obvious. The less functional a person is before they are intubated and put on a respirator, the less likely that they are going to survive this illness, if that's what's necessary. The less likely that even if they survive, that they will be weaned off of a respirator. And even if those things happen, the less likely that they will be able to get back near their baseline level of functioning. And the probability may not be zero. At the same time, it needs to be weighed against the pain and suffering that being sedated and put on a respirator involves. And that's a careful calculation. Again, it's not that there's patients, it's not a question whether they deserve a chance or not on a ventilator. I think it's a careful calculation about, is the small likelihood that they can that a meaningful living can be restored, is it worth the risks of just increased pain and suffering? And I think there's patients for whom these are decisions that we should be making all the time. We should be having more upfront conversations. We should be more ready to make calls about that. Perhaps the pandemic has only kind of pushed us to make decisions where we previously had not been. One more point in this regard, and I think this is something that I've experienced as a difference between the U.S. and Israel, working in two different healthcare systems simultaneously is really interesting, because you see a different culture in each of them, and the culture, it's not necessarily about religion or religiosity, but just different countries and different cultures. What I mean by that is that in my own personal experience, I found that in the U.S., families and doctors after them tend to be more aggressive in their end-of-life decision care making, aggressive in the sense of wanting to pursue more interventions. And that in Israel, the opposite is true. In Israel, there's more acceptance of dying as a natural process. That's true for families. That's true for the doctors and nurses and everyone involved. And what's fascinating to me is that it's not an issue of religiosity. It's not an issue of your religion. It's true in Israel, whether you are Haredi or Chiloni, you know, observant or non-observant, whether you are Arab or whether you are Jewish, that it seems across the board, there's just a more natural encounter with the end of life and in death. And that, you know, in the U.S., I have careful conversations with families about, you know, your loved one's in a very precarious situation. Would you want us to put a tube down their throat? Would you want us to do other kinds of interventions? And sometimes I say that in Israel, and I say it very carefully to families that I think are going to be very insistent, and they look at me as if I were asking, would you like me to torture your loved one? As if I've just landed from outer space and I have no sense, I have no humanistic qualities. It's really fascinating. I'm not a sociologist, and I don't want to engage in too much speculation why that is. Throw out a couple ideas. I think in the U.S., there is a very strong confidence in technology and its ability to heal people. I think in some ways that's a self-inflicted wound by the healthcare system. We put up the billboards, we recruit people to our hospitals, we promise them we can do everything, and then we can't. I think another factor is the degree of family involvement. Just an interesting fact, if I compare, U.S. is a big country, and there's geographic distancing between loved ones. If I compare the number of patients I see in the U.S. who, and it's elderly, infirm patients who come to the ER without family members, versus the same in Israel, I think in Israel there's a lot more family involvement and surrounding. And I speculate, anyone who has real data out there as well is welcome to refute me, but I speculate that the more the family is engaged in ongoing care, the my own feeling sense is that the less the family is pushing for every kind of intervention possible. Just an interesting point. And like I said, my major point is that this has kind of, the pandemic has uncovered this, but I don't think this is really a pandemic issue, meaning thank God there is not rationing going on out there, but perhaps facing a pandemic, it's made us more rational in our caregiving and our thinking. Point number two is something that's a unique challenge of the Corona Emergency Department. And I think this, the media may not cover this. By the way, Rabbi Weissman encouraged me to mention that some of you may have seen the video of Shari Tzedek closing its Corona department ward. For the record, that was one of many Corona wards. So thank God we've gone down to the numbers and some of the wards that were converted to Corona can go back to being regular medical wards. We still have Corona wards. Unfortunately, patients are still in Corona ICUs and the Corona Emergency Department is still up and functioning. I'm still working there later this week. But I think people think Corona, they think about Corona wards with beds and beds of patients who are Corona positive. The challenge of the emergency department is that we get patients and we don't know if they have Corona or not. And why is that so challenging? Because there's a lot of restrictions and limitations in our emergency department. There are things that we cannot do because they would put staff at risk. There's kinds of treatments that we cannot offer. And if the patients were only Corona positive patients, we would say, well, that's the fault of coronavirus and that's the fault of the pandemic. What can we do? But we also know that we're seeing many patients who we don't know if they have Corona. In fact, many of them may not. We're just not sure. We can't send them out into the regular emergency department until it has been disproven. Meanwhile, they're getting what's honestly suboptimal care in our environment. And that's a very tricky situation. Patients who you cannot send them to the regular emergency department because you don't know what they have and how they might infect other healthy people. On the other hand, you know that you're not giving them their optimal care and finding that balance. One of my colleagues said early on when I came aboard that in his opinion, there will be people who will die not from Corona, but because of Corona, meaning in addition to people who are taken by the coronavirus, people who will suffer because of how working with Corona has turned the hospital upside down. It's a very tricky issue. And sometimes you're making a borderline call about who is very unlikely to have coronavirus, even though there's some respiratory symptoms, so that you can send them to a different area where they can get optimal care and where you can't take that risk. That is a big challenge. And I guess that brings me to the third ethical challenge, which I wanted to mention. Again, not so much in terms of medicine and medical decision-making, but more in terms of the human aspect. The working in a corona, whether in a corona emergency department or even in a corona ward, it's like practicing medicine on your head with one hand tied behind your back. First of all, in terms of the things that you can't do. And second of all, just in terms of an entire environment and context that we're not used to. I like sitting on my patients' beds and talking to them. I like looking them at their eye. I like it when they can read my facial expression. I deliberately, personal feeling that I don't really like white coats and I think they create barriers between patients and doctors. And I gave mine up a long time ago. And suddenly, really the only way I can describe it is it's like that scene out of E.T. when the scientists show up at the door in their spacesuits. That's what it looks like when you enter our environment. We are dressed head to toe. We look like we're wearing spacesuits. You can only see our eyes. We deliberately limit our contact and exposure. We go into a room a minimal number of times. Probably even worse than that is that family is not allowed into the Corona ED. Israel is actually at the forefront of allowing families to go in to visit patients in Corona wards, especially patients who may be near the end of life, so that they don't die alone. That's also a tricky question. Do you give up scarce resources to let family protect themselves with masks and so on? In Israel, we have the resources to do that, but in the emergency department, we don't have that flexibility. And that's not the medicine that we like to practice. And for the doctors out there, that's not the medicine that we know. I've seen it, unfortunately, on both sides. I had a first cousin whose husband became ill and very ill with coronavirus, whom I was in close contact with, who were helping to guide through a process, counsel, answer questions. And all of a sudden, I'm not the doctor, but I'm part of the receiving end as a family member, where she tells me that she can't visit. She's getting her news third or fourth hand. And so hard to get in touch and to find out what's going on. Ultimately, unfortunately, this cousin succumbed to coronavirus. And it's not a pleasant experience. We know that illness and death can't always be a pleasant experience, but sometimes it's worse than others. And this virus is a vicious virus in that sense. It's not easy having to put our own self-interest first, in the sense that we have to be maximally protected, and we have to make tough choices about what we can involve in. At the same time, it's not really our self-interest. We know that if we're exposed to a patient who's positive for corona, then we end up in isolation, and the department suffers, and future patients suffer. So we think we are doing it for the greater good, but it doesn't feel good. And we'd all like to get back to practicing medicine as we know it and as we love it. Let me close with two final thoughts. One is that this is a difficult and trying time. It's a sad time, and it is a sobering time and humbling for humanity as a whole, literally as a whole, and for medicine in particular. I think anyone involved in medicine has been sobered by this whole trajectory. At the same time, I do try on a daily basis to keep in mind not just the victims of corona, but the thousands upon thousands of survivors, so to speak. And perhaps it's not too extreme to call them that. People who have recovered on their own, people who have recovered specifically because of the abilities and capabilities of modern medicine. And as my wife Shana pointed out, thank God this is not the plague and this is not the Spanish flu, partly because of what medicine is able to do. And harbei shluchim lamakom, God has many messengers. And if all the healthcare workers are just some of them, we feel good about what we're able to do. And we thank God for making that possible. And my final observation is to come back to the Rambam that I quoted earlier. And I remind you, the Rambam said that if you have Torah learning, you have a mitzvah. If the world needs you, if there's no one else to do that, I shouldn't say the world, if the mitzvah needs you, if there's something, could be something even small, you need to interrupt your learning and go perform that mitzvah. Moi Virabi Rav Aaron Lichtenstein had an interesting insight on this Rambam. He suggested that the point of the Rambam is not just that the performance of the mitzvah supersedes the learning of Torah at that moment, but that one actually preserves the learning of Torah by interrupting it for a mitzvah. We're one to learn and to continue learning even when there were other needs beckoning. It wouldn't just be a mismanagement of priorities. The Torah itself would be worthless. That Torah, God insists, always has to be something that's connected to the world of action. That Torah has to be something that is deeply rooted in human experience and even human suffering. And the Torah that ever becomes disconnected from that ceases to be the Torah that God intended. If one were to ignore that calling and just to continue learning uninterruptedly, then the Torah wouldn't be Torah at all. One interrupts the Torah not just to do what's required, but to preserve the Torah itself. And I keep that in mind. I think it's in that spirit that I've reordered my priorities right now, and I don't think I'm alone. And it's something that I think it's the calling of the moment. I do hope that the Lichtenstein also used to emphasize the last two words of the Rambam, which was V'yachzor l'talmudo, that when the mitzvah is completed, one gets back to their engagement, whether it's in learning or whether it's in teaching and education. And that too is part of preserving the Torah. If one learns Torah and drops it to do a mitzvah and never comes back, then yes, the mitzvah has just superseded the Torah. But if one is able to come back to the Torah, then one has shown that the mitzvah and the Torah are integrated, and then one has preserved the meaning of the Torah all along. I look forward to a day that everyone can get back to their normal lives, to their routines, and I can get back to my routine as well. And in the meantime, everyone will keep doing what they're doing to see us through this crisis. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. If anyone has any specific questions for Rabbi Dr. Goldberg, if you, rather than have everyone just call them out or even with hand raising, we have a lot of people on this Zoom, Baruch Hashem. If you could type your questions into the chat, we'd appreciate it. And I hope Rabbi Goldberg will be able to get to as many of them as he can.
More than a question, I have a comment on personal experience, if you don't mind. You're a little too young to appreciate what went on in the mid-80s with something called HIV. I was in dental school at the time, and it was a major crisis. It's the crisis that basically led up to everything that goes on right now in terms of personal protective equipment and modes and aspects of disinfection and everything that goes on. I had a pathology professor, I should say, who had a very interesting perspective at the time, and is also very relevant now. And that is that we are actually a generation that does not know from people dying from infectious disease for two reasons. Because over the last 100 years, we have had the advent of both antibiotics and vaccines. And because of these, I mean, there was a time when dental disease was the fourth biggest killer in the United States. Because of antibiotics and vaccines, we don't see people succumbing to these types of diseases anymore. The other point that I want to bring up is, I don't know if you've seen the reports in Israel, but they've been monitoring pollution levels in major cities in the United States, and over the last 2 months, they have gone down significantly. And the question is, you can say, how can you say there could be a benefit to this situation? Well, one of the benefits is this decrease in pollution, because in theory, decreased pollution could be helping to save this planet. And let's face it, without this planet, none of us will be around. Another benefit, I'm sure you've seen all the postings and the stories about people getting out on their balconies in Israel and singing songs together every night. It's bringing families together. Do I dare say there could be some benefits to this that could be long-term?
Judah, you'll have to unmute yourself. There was also a couple of questions in the chat. Okay, go ahead.
We can give me 1 second. I missed them. Okay, let me see if I can address what's come in at least so far. First of all, in terms of Dr. Toporowski, is it? In terms of the comments, I think they're pertinent. Certainly true about, it is true that I didn't miss the HIV epidemic. I was at the tail end, if not beyond, by the time I matriculated into medical school. In terms of infectious disease, I think you're absolutely right that we're a generation that doesn't know, and that speaks to other issues that we have in terms of vaccination rates and other issues. I guess one comment I wouldn't make is that it's true and not true in the sense that infectious disease is a silent killer in our communities in the world, as some people have tried to say for the last 2 months. It's not my area, but like, for instance, influenza takes a lot of lives annually, and it goes under the radar, and it's gone under the radar. And my children ask me, Abba, how long are we not shake hands? And I say, you know what? We may have learned our lessons that we should never shake hands from September to May every year in shul. And it's just enough to wave. Even when we go back to shul, maybe we're done with shaking hands, because maybe we've been sensitized to the price of that as well. That remains to be seen. As far as the second point, in terms of, let's say, pollution unity, I think every crisis can bring out either the worst in people or the best in people. It's hard to imagine it a benefit. I don't want to comment about a kind of cause effect or whether it's worthwhile, but it is true. There are things that, halavai, the pandemic is happening. People have lost their lives, many people. It would be a shame if that happened and nothing good came out versus we found something good to walk away with or something that we could learn and take with us. It wouldn't justify or explain or in any way mitigate the extent, the sense of tragedy, but why not learn things? I think one thing we may have learned is that we are actually much more adaptable as a species than we thought we were. Even when it comes to the issue of climate change, not our topic for today, but one of the things we thought is that we just can't break habits. It's never going to happen. And the entire globe actually broke some of its habits.
I wonder if this is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought upon us to help wake us up, to help us realize, and maybe with the positive effects it developed with the planet to help save us in a crazy way.
Well, one thing for sure, one thing I will not do is guess about HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
As a physician, if you have a limb that is severely diseased, sometimes you have to cut it off to save the whole body.
Yeah, I'm going to leave the theodicy to Rabbi Weissman and Rabbi Lerner. They'll be giving a follow-up Zoom to explain why bad things happen to good people after we finish this session. But if I can, I guess, address some of the other questions that came in. First of all, from Dr. Lussbader, about patients who are not going to come off ventilators. Great question. I have no idea. Thank God our numbers, the numbers in Israel are changing every day. I don't know if they're because patients are, the number of ventilated patients are going down. I honestly don't know if it's because patients are dying or because they're being weaned. The numbers countrywide, thank God, are not that bad. I think the latest was about, I don't know. Certainly it's counted in the hundreds or under 200, not a massive amount, but it is a very relevant question. Certainly replaces it of a higher patient load. My dear mother-in-law asked the question about the fact that family members can help patients recover. It's absolutely true. It's true in two senses. Number one, in terms of their recovery, it's even more true in terms of their patient care, their history, in terms of advocates. I have patients who don't speak Hebrew. Some of them speak Arabic. I can find an Arabic translator, but even there's no one to help you sort through a history and to help advocate for the patient like a family member. Family members, they drive me crazy. And I hate it, but it's good for the patients. I know that. It is a real problem, and it is a price. Amongst the things that are bad for patients, we know one of the things that's bad for them is to be isolated, physically isolated, emotionally isolated, and not have access to their family members. Let me see what else is here. Yeah, I see what Dr. Weinblatt is writing here in terms of the things the New York hospitals contend with. I don't know each hospital, I don't know each case and where the line, where one draws the line between rational decision-making and actual rationing. And I don't mean to say that hospitals did not have to cross over that line in New York, in Italy, or elsewhere. But even even those decision makings of who should be, who has a very poor chance at meaningful survival, and it's difficult because we as doctors, we'd like to say zero or not. But any doctor who tells you zero is just, we can never say zero. We just don't know. We don't know prognoses that well. At the same time, I think, I remember having this conversation actually many years ago in I think it was a Project Identity event in the Yangizhou Great Neck, this exact conversation. On the one hand, to make prognoses is to be incredibly arrogant. At the same time, to refuse to give families information that they desperately want and need to make rational choices is cruel as well. And we have to thread that needle between doing the same and then also supporting them in the kinds of decisions that they make. Halacha does have things to say about rationing care. But I apologize, I'm not really prepared to, I don't know enough to address it at this time. In places where rationing is relevant, certainly halacha has will weigh in as well, but that's for a different discussion.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. So thank you all for coming out for this wonderful lunch and learn. Thank you, Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg, for this very stimulating and interesting discussion. And I think the amount of people who are here testifies to how interested they are in your thoughts, but also in how much they want to support you in all that you're doing. We say it here in America all the time, how much we think of our doctors and our nurses and, you know, even the people who deliver our packages every day, how heroic they are, because the world would really, really cease to function if it wasn't for all you're doing. So thank you for the sacrifice you're making. Thank you to your family for letting you and supporting you in that sacrifice. And we wish you nothing but hatzlacha, and look forward to the day where we can wave to you in person.
Thank you, Rabbi Weissman and Rabbi Lerner. It's been a pleasure, and God bless all of the healthcare practitioners in this audience and beyond. May we have siyata d'shmaya.
Amen.
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 Thank you. Thank you, Judah. Thank you. Thanks, Judah.
Thank you, Judah.
Thank you, Judah.
Thank you, Judah.
Thank you, Doctor. Kol hakavod, b'hatzlacha.
Thank you.